Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Bobby Coleman, and we'll be moderating today's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audiences to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panelists. First, Justin Crossley, founder of the Brewing Network, a multimedia resource for brewers, and host of the Brewcast on CBS Radio here in San Francisco. He also wrote to me to include that he's sure that I know that he doesn't take himself all that seriously, but he does take beer seriously. So anything you intro with will be fine, but don't afraid to throw in strikingly handsome and abundantly talented, you know, if you have time. Also on the panel is John Foster, who is the co-host of the webcast beerschool.com. He's a fabulous local raconteur and enthusiast for beer of all types. Nico Fricha is the co-owner of the 21st Amendment Restaurant and Brewery. One feature from his official bio on the 21st Amendment website is that after graduating Northwestern University in 1986 with a degree in acting, speech, and theater arts, that guaranteed a long career in the restaurant business. Nico also, according to his bio, assisted the famed Hollywood director Billy Wilder in producing The Perfect Martini. Next on the panel is Dan Gordon. Dan is the co-founder and director of brewing operations for Gordon Biersch. His education is at UC Berkeley in economics.
Go Bears.
And has a brewing engineering degree from the Technical University of Munich at Weihenstephan. He started Gordon Biersch in 1988 in Palo Alto, and the company has grown to 24 brewing restaurants nationwide with a state-of-the-art production brewery and bottling facility in San Jose, which is the place of his birth. Married 23 years with three kids, one's in college, so he asks that you please buy a lot of Gordon Biersch six-packs. And Dave McLean is the owner and brewmaster at the Magnolia Pub and Brewery and Alembic Bar, both in the Haight-Ashbury. He's been in the forefront of the nexus between food and gastronomic trends, as well as brewing and local sourcing here in the Bay Area. So Dave is a very articulate spokesperson for the slow food combination with beer. And the reason I was asked to moderate today was because I helped found the San Francisco Brewers Guild, which has a lot of information on local beer at sfbrewersguild.org. I'm also a local attorney and social responsibility advisor. The story of San Francisco beer, which we're all so proud of, is a story that probably begins with the beginning of civilization. We don't know exactly what the natives did in Yerba Buena Cove before the non-native Aravistes came, but we do know that they were blessed with incredible geography, with the fog, with the San Francisco Bay, one of the world's most magnificent estuaries. We know that they had fertile valleys to the north, south, and east. And we know that they didn't anticipate that gold would be found and the entire world would rush through over many impediments to come to the Bay Area in order to access those resources, and in that pioneering spirit to create a new world. Part of that story, which we're going to explore tonight, includes innovation, adaptation, and new ideas. And San Francisco, in terms of the arts, in terms of business, entrepreneurship, entertainment, even in terms of technology and the computer culture, we'll get into that, has always attracted people who were willing to change the world, people who were willing to combine new things in new ways, and to express themselves as people with a respect for the place and for the products they were offering the public. Now, in recent years, there's been a gastronomic explosion in America, and beer's always been a part of that, in the Bay Area particularly. When you think about the magic of fermentation, whether it be in cheese, in bread, in wine, in beer, there's something very mysterious about that. But to us in the craft brewing segment, which is now increasingly successful again as it comes in waves, we see that the idea of sustainability, of low mileage on the products as they reach market, we know that freshness and flavor are very valued, and consequently we have a very special place in the story of American food. And in San Francisco, we also have North America's only indigenous beer style, which is a brand of Anchor's beer, and Anchor's steam beer is also a very, very important part of San Francisco brewing history. And in fact, the purchase of Anchor by Fritz Maytag in 1965 for a brewery that was established in 1896 is the turning point in the American brewing renaissance. And Fritz Maytag gets the credit for being the pioneer in that sense. So with that, I'd like to put the question initially to John Foster about what the current beer scene is like in San Francisco. And with John's webcasting on beerschool.com, that may be a good jumping off point.
Thank you, Bob. So the thing with San Francisco beer is, like San Francisco since it started, it's always been about helping other people. So the brewers that are currently brewing, they're all friends. They all know each other for the most part. Right, guys? When brewing first started becoming a new business, a new thing, Fritz Maytag would offer to help the brewers with yeast, with hops, with things that they couldn't get so that they could start their brewing and makes things happen. Much the same way that when the computer boom happened in the early or in the late 70s with the Homebrew Computer Club, with engineers getting together, trading secrets, trading coding styles, trading circuit boards, all this stuff was shared. And you know, if somebody needed something, they stepped up to the plate to make that happen. The other thing that's really amazing about San Francisco brewing right now is that it's led in not just the beer experience, but the food experience. So lots of amazing things are being served in the breweries. So you go for the beer and you stay for the food, which makes it a grand experience. And then if you decide, well, I don't really want some beer, I'm going to have some really good food, that's fun too. What can I say about... So the other thing is that we're basically 40 square miles, and there's 11 breweries within this space. So we can go to someplace different every single day and not repeat ourselves for 10 whole days.
Which we've all done.
Yeah, we've all done that. And so within San Francisco, you can get to all these places by a cab, by a train, by a bus, by a boat, by walking. And I don't know of very many other places that allow you to get to all these places without driving. And that's very key to experiencing this.
I think I wish Fritz was here, too, and maybe he'll make it with us, but... the integral part of starting the history of beer is definitely with Anchor Steam. And with what John is mentioning about all the help, I mean, Anchor even started, here was this brewery when Fritz Maytag came in to take over that was about to go under, and the San Francisco beer scene wouldn't be what it is today if it did. And this man stepped in and took over the brewery, and since then has made the successful Anchor Steam beer that it is today. So the help of beer started even then. And I think that there's not a brewer in the room or in the San Francisco Brewers Guild that wouldn't thank Fritz for doing that and kind of keeping that going until the rest of us caught on and new craft breweries sprouted up.
It's really the cornerstone of craft beer. I mean, if you go back to watch where beer started up from, it is Anchor Steam that sort of starts this new trend of beers that taste like something, that have flavor, that have hops, that reintroduce the styles of beer that were basically lost to the mass market because marketing said, you will eat this, you will try this, you will love this. And that's not the way that this city has been traditionally. People want to experience different cultures and different things. So,
before we leave these encomiums to Fritz Maytag, which are well-deserved, I found a quote from the San Francisco Chronicle, January 29th, 2004, from Fritz. He said, "In a world of mass production and homogeneity, people are looking for substance and products with an interesting story. We're all looking for real meaning. I find it very satisfying to put real meaning into the products." He also said, "Beer does not make itself properly by itself. It takes an element of mystery and of things that no one can understand." And I think when he says that, he's referring to that mystery of fermentation and the improvisation that goes on in the brewing process. Dave, would you agree?
Yeah, that's part of the magic that happens, definitely. You know, you put raw materials in and there's the obvious inputs, but what happens in the fermenter is sort of the magic that we've spent 8,000 years trying to understand, and there's still some element of mystery to it. And yeah, he's right on with that. It's the part that we can turn around and say, you know, something else helped make this beer other than humans.
Fritz had been studying Japanese language and literature at Stanford. And the way the story goes, he was in North Beach at the old spaghetti factory, and the owner, Freddie Q, knew that Fritz was a big fan of the Anchor Steam beer, and he also knew that the brewery was about to close. And Fritz went to the brewery, fell in love, and decided to invest. Eventually, the investment was the equivalent price of a used car, which, you know, at that time might have been a considerable amount of money for a grad student, but in Fritz's case, he acquired the company. Years later, when I was a grad student at Stanford, I went to a recently renovated movie theater in Palo Alto that was the original and the first location still active of Gordon Biersch Brewing Company. And I'm pleased, so pleased that Dan Gordon is on the panel to talk about what those days were like.
It just cracks me up there when you're talking about Fritz and as a grad student barely eking it out. I wish my name was Maytag when I was born too. it would have helped out me able to buy my brewery a little easier. I wouldn't have had to raise the money, knocking on doors and writing a business plan and pounding the pavement. So that cracks me up. But yeah, I saw those magnificent men in their flying machines and Mary Poppins at the original Gordon Biersch in Palo Alto. That was great for me because I grew up in Los Altos, about 4 miles away. So it was a nice welcome home, more or less, being able to come back after living in Germany for 5 years and start up the company in my hometown.
Dan is also being a little modest because he was the first American in 50 years to graduate from a 5-year technical engineering program at one of the world's most illustrious brewing schools, Weinerstaffen. So,
well, thanks for the plug. I studied really hard. You know, that's what can I say? It was a unique experience because I arrived in late October when classes were going to start the following week, and I didn't realize when I applied to the program that it was competitive. You know, everyone assumes that grad school you get in, you're going to, you know, plug through your 2 to 5 years or whatever, you know, 12 years if you're studying physics. and then I found out that the attrition rate was about 85%, so I did have to work really hard. I figured that passing grades at Weinstephan were the equivalent to A work at Berkeley. So it was a challenge, yeah. But powered out, made it through, and bought brewing machinery halfway through. It was kind of unique. My wife and I had just gotten married about in my second year of grad school, and we had this money she had saved so we could live for the next 3 years. And we took all that and bought brewing machinery, and it's actually the brew house that's in Palo Alto. And just going back on the Fritz Maytag story, it was interesting. I brought kegs of yeast over from Germany to start off our facility in Palo Alto. And I'm doing the first brew and going out to pitch the yeast. And that's the technical jargon, and you know, throwing yeast into the fermenter to begin a fermentation process. And the entire keg of yeast explodes in my face as I open it up. So we were without yeast, and I got on the horn and called up Anchor and Mark Carpenter who runs the brewery actually. Fritz is the philosopher and visionary for Anchor, but Mark actually does all the real work. And everyone in his staff can attest to that. He's a great guy. And they just gave us the yeast like Bobby was referring to right off the bat. No questions asked. Helped us in our moment of need and forever grateful for that. So the camaraderie truly does exist amongst the San Francisco brewers. Met Nico a long time ago. He was interviewing me for an article. And I don't think it came up that he was a phenomenal journalist at one time in his life. And in addition to being a male model prior,
thanks.
You probably saw the Macy's ads a few years ago. But that's those are kind of there's a little linkage here amongst us all.
Most of us brewers had completely prior lives before ending up where we ended up. Well, not Dan.
Actually, I played jazz trombone for getting my way through grad school, so I did have a little element, and did catering when I was 14. You know,
when my journalism shifted into beer, I actually succeeded Nico at the Celebrator magazine. So those were big shoes to fill because he was really encyclopedic in his knowledge and quite a skillful writer, which leads me to ask Nico about the various cycles in craft brewing. The 21st Amendment, of course, is named for the Amendment of Repeal in 1933, following the 13-year experiment that the United States had with alcohol prohibition. It started with the Volstead Act in 1920, the 18th Amendment. Now, we've seen cycles of flavor and diversity in beer that have been on the up and the down. For example, on the Anchor Brewing website, you'll see a reproduction of a directory listing of breweries in San Francisco that number more than two dozen, all in all the neighborhoods in town. One of them is the successor to today's Wonder Brewing in the Inner Sunset, which is the revived Wonder Brewing from the 1890s that also went through a name, Bavaria Brewing. But anyway, we had so many breweries in San Francisco that it was considered, you know, vital to each neighborhood so that they could get their local beer and everyone had their favorites. With Prohibition, that changed, didn't it, Nico?
Well, Prohibition, of course, changed everything about beer in this country, and mostly for the worst. Only a few of the largest breweries were able to reopen after Prohibition, but to get back to what you were just saying about the number of breweries, and this was the case throughout the country, there were more breweries in America by far in the 1870s than there are today, probably three, four, five times as many with a fraction of the population. And when we were trying to settle on a name for our pub and restaurant, which is now the 21st Amendment, we were very much interested in the history of San Francisco and the history of San Francisco brewing. So we went back to some of the old record books, directories, journals, phone books from about 1850 on until early 1900s to just kind of get a feel for what the names of these places were. And what we discovered was that the names were rather pedestrian. There were things like the General Brewing Company and the United States Brewing Company, the Acme Brewing Company and the Phoenix Brewing Company, and for the Cal fans, the Blue and Gold Brewing Company. But nothing really that jumped out at you and made you go, wow, that's a dynamic name for a place. The thing that really did strike a nerve was that at one point I'm looking at the directories and realize that in the year 1900, there were more than 40 breweries operating within the city limits of San Francisco. And there was a population of about 340,000 in San Francisco in 1900, which was quite a lot. It had become, I think, the ninth largest city in America by then because of the gold rush. and the post-Gold Rush population boom. But today we have, John said it was 11, I thought it was 9, but somewhere in there, 9, 10 breweries in the city of San Francisco with a population of over 750,000. So what that means really is that there was a brewery on every corner, and it was integral to the community and to the neighborhood, just the way that the English pub has always been in England. And it provided a place for community. A lot of these places had beer gardens. They were the places that families all gathered on the weekends on a Sunday afternoon after church. They would all go to the beer gardens and drink German lager beer. And, of course, Prohibition wiped that out. So we ultimately settled on the 21st Amendment because we felt that it captured sort of the essence of the right to brew beer again and the right to reclaim that culture that was lost to Prohibition. I'm not sure if that answers your question about...
Well, there were other cycles, too. For example, the craft beer has gone through about three generations, starting with the brewpub acts that allowed for the on-site sale of brewed beer in the 80s, and then the boom in the 90s, and maybe a third generation happening now as the growth expands.
Yeah, it all sort of started with Fritz in the early 1970s. He, of course, took over Anchor in 1965, but he wasn't profitable until about 10 years later. And there was a sea change going on in American culture overall, in gastronomy and in a lot of things, that was a combination of... There was a blandification of the American diet in the 50s, where processed foods started becoming popular and frozen foods and all that kind of thing. And then in the early 1970s, you had your anti-establishment attitude in general that, of course, pervaded the youth, but was starting to trickle down to a lot of generations. And you had Alice Waters opening up Chez Panisse in, I think, 1971. And you had Fritz Maytag. And you had Robert Mondavi starting to make world-class wines, competing with the wines of Europe. In the early 1970s, he won an incredibly prestigious award. So you suddenly had all this organic, artisanal products being made again, and there was a real interest in that and a real lust for that with the American public. And Fritz started that, and we sort of had this nascent movement where we had some of the early people that got into it. The laws were very anachronistic. We still had homebrewing was illegal. Brew pubs were illegal. A small brewery could only sell its product to wholesalers and to retail outlets. They couldn't sell any product on site. And all that took a while to change. President Carter in 1978 finally made homebrewing legal. And then in 1982, actually Fritz and Jack McAuliffe, who founded the New Albion Brewery in 1977, worked on legislation to change the thing about the brewery. So we started to have brew pubs. That was actually legalized in January of 1983. So when that happened, all of a sudden, you got guys like Ken Grossman and guys like Don Barkley from Mendocino and people all over the Western seaboard largely that started opening up brew pubs and small breweries. And they were mostly home brewers. And nobody knew anything about brewing. There was very little literature. There were no good books on really on homebrewing until the mid-1980s. There wasn't a lot of literature except for arcane tomes by Belgian brewmasters and Louis Pasteur and other stuff like that. So people learned as they went. And it wasn't until the early 1990s where we had this just boom between 1990 and 1995 of new breweries in America, where suddenly people had been in the business for 10 years. And so we went through a shakeout, and we've kind of come around full circle, and I don't want to be too long-winded, because I'm sure some of the other guys will have something to say about that.
One of the things that comes to mind as Nico recounts this fascinating history is that the question of why would that happen in the Bay Area? Would it be something about the fog in the air, the yeast that produces the sourdough bread, something about the music and art and culture, the diversity of the port, the maritime history, the Barbary Coast, the pioneers, or... is it an accident? Dave McLean, you know, we've done work with Slow Food USA. In fact, there's a Brewers Guild event coming up, Slow Beer, which is coming up on
March 1st,
right. Noon to 4.
The County Fair Building in Golden Gate Park. Right.
And so as we look at the farmers markets here and we see that people go and get to meet the producer, here they get to meet the people who brew the beer every third Thursday at a revolving list of the local breweries and beer spots. Also at brewersguild.org, You can find that list every month where that's going to be on Thursday nights, 6 to 9. But why in San Francisco? Why would it be the place, the nexus for all that freedom and creativity?
Well, I mean, if you look at Slow Food as an organization, it started in Italy in the mid-80s, and it itself was a grassroots consumer movement that was struggling to protect the traditions and the parts of their food culture in Italy that were held dear and that a few folks felt were being threatened. And it struck a nerve to the point where it was extremely successful in building membership very quickly, and there was a great deal of romance with it. People really connected with it. They said, "Yeah, these traditions are important to us." And Carlo Petrini, who was the founder of Slow Food, I first heard him say this at a talk he gave here at Fort Mason a couple years ago. But he said that Slow Food was modeled in part on what he observed from CAMRA, the Campaign for Real Ale, which was the consumer organization in the early 70s in Great Britain that single-handedly saved cask-conditioned beer, which was the British traditional way of brewing that was in danger of being replaced by modern methods that were more predictable and easier to scale up on a mass level. And so Slow Food itself came from observing that there are, that this grassroots beer movement in England, was so successful, people could really connect with preserving their traditions. And I think that's probably true here in the Bay Area, too. It's a place where people really do feel a strong sense of connection, probably thanks to, a few pioneers like Alice Waters and the other folks that brought the farm back to the table in the early 70s. People really seem to feel a visceral sense. It's the bounty of the Bay Area, the fact that so much great local produce and local foods come from here. People have a sense of ownership, I think. They really connect with the food and the beverage, the wine industry. And it just makes sense to me that kind of sentiment, as seen in the real ale movement in England in the 70s and maybe Slow Food in the 80s, could also happen here in the Bay Area in the 80s, 90s, and now. It's that same sort of romance and connection to our traditional food and the fact that we really cherish it and don't want to lose it.
Thanks, Dave. Before we get into more discussion about the diversity of flavors, what one is likely to encounter as they go about exploring San Francisco beer, all the different styles, and also the demographics and the current nature of the beer enthusiast audience, we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California and that you're listening to the San Francisco Beer Story with our panel, Justin Crossley, radio host and brewcaster, the Brewing Network and CBS Radio, John Foster, co-host beerschool.com, a webcast, Nico Fricia, beer journalist and co-owner 21st Amendment Restaurant and Brewery, Dan Gordon, the co-founder and director of brewing operations of Gordon Biersch, and David McLean, owner and brewmaster, Magnolia Pub and Brewery and the Alembic Bar in the Haight-Ashbury. We are collecting questions, and we will be selecting these questions and giving them to the panel, so please feel free to supply those. Cards are going around. Justin Crossley, the current situation in San Francisco, we have the craft beer success just booming, double-digit growth every period now. And you are addressing an audience on broadcast, on the internet radio. In a way, you have your finger on the pulse of what is coming and what's around the corner for us. What's up?
Yeah, my show's pretty much the reason all these guys are successful as they are today. Dan can attest to that.
Yes.
Before I answer that, a good question from the audience was, why is this panel all extra large sized?
I am not extra large sized.
You're not?
I'm 3X, baby.
The radio audience will believe you guys.
They forgot some X's in this question.
I think it's interesting to watch the beer audience that I have and the people that I meet in the beer world. It kind of goes back to the question of why San Francisco, why is it successful here? And, of course, it's successful everywhere. Craft beer in America now, I think never in history has America been a place that the rest of the world looked at for beer and for doing new and fascinating and amazing things with beer because we stole it all from everywhere else. But now, that's not the case. Now, German brewers and English brewers and Belgian brewers, they're looking to what's happening here in the Bay Area and here in America all over, and they're looking at American craft brewers and saying, wow, they're really pushing the envelope and really taking it a step further. And that's part of the excitement of craft beer in general, part of why I think you're all here. It's no accident that San Francisco is a very successful beer scene. There's a lot of energy here. There's a lot of excitement here. And I think one thing that's been left out so far as we pontificate about how fascinating beer is there's a lot of fun to be had here. And there's a lot of fun to be had in the beer industry in general. Like Nico was saying, you know, I don't really know anybody that grew up, you know, as a kid going, you know, except for Dan, I want to be a brewer when I grow up. It's usually the result of a lot of not-so-fun jobs and a lot of things. You have a group of really passionate people that just decided, I can't work at a desk and I can't. One of the other co-founders of the 21st Amendment, he thought he was going to be a lawyer. And all of us who know him know that's a ridiculous notion. And the beer industry is just made up of these people who thought, you know, I want to be more creative and I want to do something that I'm really passionate about. And that passion starts with the brewers and it goes right out the beer glass and into, you know, people like me and yourselves who get to drink it. And the more I do radio about beer, which, by the way, is the best job on earth, the more I realize that people really are excited about this thing because it's not just a... It's not just a beverage. It never has been. Even when beer was first made, which was most likely by accident, it was much more of a cultural thing, and it was much more of a sharing this with your friends and with your family. And like that kind of thing is why people get excited about beer and why the San Francisco beer scene is thriving, because people here are excited about culture, and they're excited to share things with other people, and they're excited about new things. So... that's why we take beer styles and turn them upside down, create new beer, and it's fascinating. It's great to be a part of this entire scene here.
One of the things that struck me about the people in the beer industry was that while competing, they also saw the merits of collaborating. So for those in the management profession, it's that new notion of co-optition, where you cooperate and compete where it's appropriate in the appropriate ways. And certainly in the camaraderie of the brewing segment, the people really like each other and hang together, and perhaps that's because of the sociability of the scene, or perhaps it's because of some of the pioneer individuals who engendered that philosophy. Or maybe it's a reflection of the American style naturally coming up to the surface. We have a lot of questions, and one of them just jumped out at me as a really fundamental question. Are there getting to be beer snobs similar to wine snobs? And
it's a great question.
I mean, one of the things that we grew up with, those of us of a certain generation, we had sandwiches as we padded off to elementary school of Wonder Bread with American cheese slices and whatever else would go on the sandwich. And although we now see all these different flavors and diversity of styles and experiences, are we losing something democratic in the process, something accessible and easy?
I'm going to say that I was at a place that will go unnamed, and I was watching everybody try these amazing Belgian beers, and they were being snobs about it. And I was like, if this is the future of beer drinking, I don't want to have any part of it. But it was fun to watch people experiencing beer for the fragile, delicate, wonderful thing that it was, to push it beyond the, I'm drinking beer and I'm watching football all Saturday and Sunday.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing wrong with that.
For some people.
I don't think I don't. I think beer snobs is a. I think we get into shaky ground. I would say a long time ago, and by a long time ago for me is yesterday, a few years ago. Beer snobs, absolutely. People were saying I couldn't drink that, I couldn't do that. But the more educated we become, and that's part of these craft brewers that are doing that, I think the less snobby us beer people get. And we enjoy really good beer, and we'll sit around and talk about it like it's wine and like it's fine food, and maybe that's snobby, but 9 out of 10 of the craft brewers I know have a six-pack of Coors Light in their refrigerator. And that is the darkest secret in craft brewing that I've just given to all of you.
Everybody, okay, how many brewers are out there? Let's do this 9 out of 10 survey right now.
I'm telling you, they all come on the show and they say...
40 brewers out here right now, and you guys got Coors Light.
They won't do it. Only one is...
All right.
And he works for that one, so he had to raise his hand.
So what's going on, Nico, with your staff, you know? Explain this one.
Ignore those men in the back. Actually, wine snob is a perfectly good term, but we don't call ourselves that in the beer world. We call ourselves beer geeks. Ah. And the fundamental difference between beer geeks and wine snobs is beer geeks do not spit.
We're told that the reason we don't spit, and I prefer the term enthusiast to geek, but that's my preference, is that the flavor sensors in the palate can't be accessed if you spit, that the beer actually has to go further
back
on the
top. The bitterness, which is an integral part of the beer flavor and beer experience and not integral to wine, is perceived on the back of the tongue. So if you spit, you don't get the bitterness and you lose the entire flavor of the beer. You can actually taste the wine by just putting it on your tongue, but you can't do that with beer.
Well, I think we've shown a quick demonstration that there's a lot of enthusiasm and exuberance in the brewing community, so the idea of the snobbery is we can't even access that at this point. There is a good question, though. Why are there no women on the panel? And, of course, we did notice that in advance and tried to...
I noticed.
I noticed.
Fritz didn't show up.
I was told there'd be women on this panel.
It was in Justin's contract.
Can I offer an answer to that?
Well, historically, we had alewives, and we had lots of women in the brewing industry, and today we do have a number of women in the brewing industry.
There are a number of women in the brewing industry, but there is a woman here in a sense, Maureen Ogle, who's an historian who has a wonderful book called Ambitious Brew, the Story of American Beer. And she is an historian who approached this as a purely historical subject, and it reads like a novel. It's absolutely wonderful, and she's probably the most knowledgeable person about American beer in this country today. So Maureen is here with us right now.
No way.
Hey, can I chime in? Can I chime in also? Dorian Watts, the assistant brewmaster, number two person at the Anheuser-Busch Brewery in Fairfield, female executive in the brewing industry, and the head of draft beer production for Anheuser-Busch. Also as a woman. So they're women, unfortunately. None of them started a brewery in San Francisco.
Dan, there's another question that might be specific to Gordon Biersch in a way. A member of the audience says, I love Bavarian beer and the beer garden experience. What local brew and pub would come closest to that experience?
Well, of course, Gordon Biersch comes to mind. I think most of us have some decks, either rooftop or oceanfront or so at the facilities. You know, there's nothing like a German beer garden I'm familiar with in San Francisco, unfortunately. If you go down to Portola Valley, there's a couple places that have some side road, you know, outdoor activity, but nothing known for its beer.
There's another question, Dan, for you. Are you totally dedicated to German beers, mostly lagers, or will you branch into other styles?
Well, we do authentic German-style beers, and not all of them are lagers. The primary, our namesake beers, Märzen, Pilsner, the Bock beers that we make, those are all German lagers. But our Hefeweizen is authentic Bavarian-style Hefeweizen, utilizing a top-fermenting yeast. Do a Kölsch in the summertime. Kölsch is the mainstay beer from Cologne. It's basically a Pilsner style beer fermented with a top fermenting yeast strain. And just for so you a little background, bottom fermenting yeast ferment at cold temperatures, which are used for making lagers. Top fermenting yeast ferment at warm temperatures and utilized for making ales. So Kölsch is a top fermenting yeast strain, and then the Hefeweizens that we make are also top fermenting. So we utilize different strains of yeast, but I am a Germanic brewer through and through. So the styles I do in my niche is really focused on authenticity and bringing back styles that really aren't that well represented even in modern day Germany even.
Dave McLean, your businesses do focus on the British end of things, but as interpreted on the West Coast and in the innovative styles that we have here. What do you think about the sort of mix that we have in San Francisco and all these different beer traditions?
I think that's the best example of the diversity in the craft beer movement. I think the fact that there are so many of us expressing our thoughts and feelings on beer making through all these different styles and it really is the melting pot, and it not just San Francisco, of course, but it's the whole U.S. craft beer movement, you know, partly because we had such a break in the history and the tradition because of Prohibition and the consolidation that happened after. There was a lot of reinventing of the wheel and trying to go back to the roots and go back to Europe, and some people drew from German roots and some people drew from English roots. The fact is that the passion is there no matter what beer style it is you're talking about. It really is. You know, I fell in love with the English styles of brewing, some really, you know, amazing balanced bitters made with some heirloom malts like Maris Otter barley. Travels through England turned me onto those beers, and I fell in love with them to the point where I realized that was the style that I wanted to make. And I'm sure that story would be repeated with variations, you know, with any of us in the room that you talk to, whether it's Belgian beer, German beer. And I think that, you know, a little trip around San Francisco visiting all these different breweries is a great lesson in, wow, there's just so much going on. There's so much diversity. Everybody has a way that they want to interpret beer and beer making. And I think that's, you know, one of the beautiful aspects of the whole craft beer movement.
Also pairing with different cuisines and different styles in the restaurants. I mean, Thirsty Bear, for example, comes to mind with the Spanish cuisine, which is a wonderful combination. And there's so much variety, but there's also variety coming around the corner, coming around the bend. For example, organic beers. And there's a question from the audience about with the burgeoning slow food movement, why don't we see more organic beers on the market generally?
It's difficult. I was reading about an organic brewer in New York today. Actually, it was just in the news today. He was calling himself an artist. And saying that the quality of his ingredients were better than your regular craft beer because they were organic and all that, which may or may not be true. I'm kind of a tree hugger in terms of I love the organic movement. I think the slow food movement, the two fit together really well. They can be separated or together. It's fine. In organic beer, and especially right now with the cost of beer ingredients going up, these guys could speak more about that than I could, but it's already becoming really expensive to make small batches of craft beer because you're buying grains in much smaller quantities and the prices of those grains are going up anyway. When you get into organic, now you're talking about an increase even on top of that, which could be anywhere from 20 to 50% or more. And in order to do it in beer, they have it's a interesting, whatever the organic certification is, they say everything in the beer has to be organic unless you can't get the ingredient. So they do allow some room for hops and things like that. A lot of organic hops are not grown, makes it difficult to make a 100% organic beer. But cost-wise, it's just very difficult. And I think that the craft beer community, the consumer in general, maybe isn't as concerned. They already know that these brewers are using the finest ingredients, and maybe the organic part of it isn't exactly the most important. So,
we start off with the advantage of Hetch Hetchy water from the Sierras and other good choices on sourcing of ingredients. But actually, I just mentioned Thirsty Bear a moment ago, and I know that they've been experimenting with organic malts and organic brewing. So we're probably going to see more of this as the resources become more available. Do you think so, Dave?
It seems like it. It seems like the resources are becoming more available. There are more choices. But at the same time, you know, it's. I think it's a wonderful thing if you can make it work and find the ingredients that you want that to produce organic beer. But, you know, it's like, you know, with the food industry, too. You know, there are plenty of great available options out there to a restaurant that's sourcing food that's local, sustainably produced. You can affix a face. The farmer that grew that tomato, you know who he is. You know what he, how he does it. Maybe no pesticides, everything that, you can really tangibly connect with that food product. And or in the case of some of the brewing supplies out there, you can connect with the same, with the beer, the malt and the hops. And I think that there's it doesn't have to have the organic, label on it or certification I'm not saying that it is organic if it doesn't have that, but it just, there are, we're all after the same thing, which is artisan products, sourcing really hard to find products produced by other people who share your values. And I think that to me, that's very satisfying to work with some of those people. And I think that, it's a very personal decision, but that decision to me is, I will go out and source a product that I fall in love with because, I just love what that person's doing to produce that product. And that is just as important to me in some cases as necessarily finding something that has a label on it that says organic. Not that that's not also a great, admirable thing.
Yeah, I just want to chime in from a technical standpoint that this is more of a philosophical issue as opposed to a tangible, meaning that the wort is boiled for an hour and a half. So the hops and the extract made from the malt, most pesticides are volatile compounds that will evaporate during the boiling process. And the chance of actually having even trace elements of residual chemicals left behind is next to nil. So beer is not the most perfect representative of an ideal organic beverage. I just wanted to, well, it's not like wine where you crush the grapes and the juice isn't handled at all. It's just fermented at that point in time. There's a process in the brewing process where it's boiled, and that's roughly an hour and a half in length, and that blows off all those volatile substances.
I'd like to do a quick exercise here to cover the whole subject of the beer and food pairings. I'd like to go down the entire panel, and I'll ask each of you to briefly describe a beer and food pairing that you personally found delightful. And tell the audience what the flavors were like. Justin?
Oh, man. I'm on an all ramen diet right now.
Yeah.
I work in radio, so I'm waiting for Dan to invite me to his house for dinner. So IPA goes wonderfully with a hot bowl of ramen.
IPA is an India Pale Ale, yeah. So named for making the long journey to India.
Well, what happens is when you have really bland kind of food just to put something in the stomach, a beer that has all the flavor that you're looking for, like an IPA, an India Pale Ale, I feel like it's a 5-star meal.
John
Speaking
Foster?
Speaking of 5-star meals, so you take some kettle chips that are barbecued and some blue cheese, and you stack that together, and that goes really well with a porter.
Right. These guys are going to do better than us. Please.
Nico, we're looking for a little elevation here.
A group of us went to an oyster bar not long ago, and they had some very nice ales on tap, but they had no stout. And traditionally, people think of shellfish like oysters going with a light white wine like a Sancerre or a Pinot Grigio, something like that. And I said, do you not have a stout on tap? And they said, well, it doesn't go very well with oysters. Michael Jackson, the late, great beer writer who just passed away recently, said that oysters are the perfect pairing with stout. And I agree because the silkiness and the richness of a stout really balances the creaminess of an oyster. And with a traditional stout like a Guinness, there's a hint of sourness, which also helps cut some of the acidity of the oyster. So oysters and stout are the perfect combination.
Dan Gordon.
Well, as you can tell from my physique, I'm certainly an expert in this category. And I'm a firm believer in a complete and balanced diet. So obviously the Märzen and the Gordon Biersch garlic fry, our contribution towards single-handedly rescuing the garlic industry in Gilroy has probably the most significant impact in culinary advances in the Bay Area in many decades, as Candlestick Park and AT&T can attest to. that would be the perfect balanced combination of a flavor experience that really can go from generation to generation. Yep. For your babies involved in the family that can't necessarily enjoy the beer, they'll dig the garlic fries. My kids do, at least.
That's going to be tough to follow, Dave McLean.
Yeah, that is a tough one. Since we're about to adjourn and actually taste some beer with cheese, I'm going to say cheese. And there's a variety of reasons, and it's... And hopefully you'll get to taste them all in a few minutes. But, you know, cheese comes from cheese is a dairy product that comes from animals that graze on grass, and beer it comes from malt, which is a grass. Malted barley is a grass. And there's a natural synergy there that just works in some amazing ways. And then beyond that, there's just a lot of really specific flavor hooks that hopefully you'll get to experience tonight. I don't know if we have a... Well, I guess... Anchor has the Maytag Blue paired with them, but there's a particular favorite of mine, which has always been blue cheese with barley wine, and particularly like a Stilton, like a really good English blue cheese. And there's just some amazing things that happen there between, you know, that blue cheese funkiness, and then there's some nuttiness and toffee notes from the barley wine. And so that's always been one of my favorites. Oysters and stout is my other favorite, but Nico took that. So yeah. I'm going to go with Stilton and barley wine.
Dave, you once explained to me why the caramelization in the brew kettle married so well with the caramelization that goes on in a lot of cooking. And one of the things that's often said is you're either looking for a complementary flavor or you're looking to contrast, because the hopping generally provides a little bitterness and is a counterpoint to the sweetness. Also, the carbonation, and one of the audience questions had to do with natural carbonation. Of course, that's the CO2 byproduct of fermentation, so the carbonation is natural. And the carbonation allows for a cutting through of the lipids in the fatty foods. So, Dave, would you remind me what you told me that time?
Well, I think... You know, the scientific reaction that happens both in the kiln in the malt house as well as in the kettle is the same as what happens in the oven or the stovetop with a lot of dishes, which is a Maillard reaction or a series of reactions. And it's amino acids and sugar and the presence of heat. It's the browning reaction. It's toast. What happens to toast when you take white bread and stick it in a toaster and that amazing complexity and depth that comes out of it that turns into something delicious. That's the same thing. And when you can, yeah, there are, you know, with a lot of wine pairings, you contrast, and with so many great beer pairings, you can find a harmony with anything that's got any kind of caramelization that occurs. There's just like a hook that marries the two together, and they kind of dovetail.
Now, if someone were to be cooking at home and they were to purchase San Francisco beer for use at home, whether it be a growler from one of the brew pubs, a vessel that they can bring home, or Speakeasy in the bottle, or Gordon Biersch in the bottle, or one of the other bottle products that are available, and they started to experiment. They wanted to do something either with potatoes, as in the garlic fries, or what would be a good starting point? John Foster, what would be a good sort of elementary exercise?
You mean in pouring the beer in the...
Well, yeah. Coach us through it, because obviously you can. There's beer de cuisine where you could cook with the beer in the item, or you could pair it, as we often see at beer dinners. But what would be something? Let's say that somebody were going to make a stew. Should they put the beer in the stew and experiment?
Of course.
If they bring a pizza home, should they try
to put a little bit of beer in the stew? A little beer in you? A little beer the stew? Beer share with the stew.
Nico, as a professor at John's Beer School, what do you recommend that people do as a home experiment using San Francisco beer?
Well, just what you said earlier, either try things that complement or things that contrast. So a food that has a lot of acidity, find a very tart, sour beer, a Saison, or perhaps a Pilsner, something that's very effervescent. Generally, like game and things that are richer and heavier go well with maltier beers like red ales. Sweeter beers like imperial stouts go very well with desserts. Chocolate and beer actually pair really well. There's a lot of styles from barley wine to imperial stouts to Belgian doubles that have some sweetness that go really well with chocolate and other desserts. So I think, start from the same point of view you would with a wine and say, let's think about what qualities this beer has and match it with a food that is similar.
We have a question, and it's a good last question. And it asks about the future of the craft beer movement in the craft beer industry here and how that's going to develop. I mean, when you think about 5 years ago, just before the San Francisco Brewers Guild was formed, we had lost a number of large beer festivals, the city's festivals, KQED, International Beer Festival. There were some festivals that featured international imports, but since then we've had four iterations of Brews on the Bay on the Jeremiah O'Brien Liberty ship from World War II, which is on the northern waterfront near Fisherman's Wharf, Pier 45. So we have started to see new traditions develop. So running through the panel, in 20 years from now, how do we see the craft beer industry developing?
Well, hopefully we'll stop being referred to as cyclical. I think the cycles are over. I think now we can start referring to alternatives and Smirnoff Ice and things like that as cyclical, and the craft beer scene is now here to stay. Nico went over it just briefly when he said that in 95 there was kind of a shaking out. And really what that meant was that the brewers that were in it to cash in and not in it to make really high-quality craft beer, they got shook out because they were making really bad beer. And I think that the consumers have left us with fantastic brewing companies. So I think we can see a beer improvement, I think more enthusiasm. And hopefully, even though John and I have done a good job of making buffoons of ourselves in terms of our cuisine, hopefully beer will continue to elevate and not be separated so much from fine food and fine wine, because it really, these guys are working just as hard to make fantastic artisan quality products as the guys in Napa are competing with the rest of the world in wine. So I think elevation and just more popularity is really what we have to see.
John Foster, what's around the corner?
We have a lot of choices about the things that we eat and the things that we put into ourselves. And so to be able to meet the guy that made the beer is really important to me. I want to know who they are because I think it brings the idea of community back in. And so with the craft brewing being a community, to be part of that, to be able to have it accessible just around the corner is really exciting. And it changes the way that I want to participate in my community. I just don't want to go to McDonald's and get some fuel and, you know, go back to work. I want to have the conversation with people. I want to influence what's happening in my community. And I do that by going to the brew pub and experiencing craft beer.
Nico Fricha?
Well, I'm going to throw a couple numbers out. Craft brewing has been around for about 25 years now in America. And in the last 3 years alone, we've had about 10% annual growth of the craft beer segment. And we have finally just topped 3% of the entire domestic beer domestic beer consumption in this country. So with all this, with 25 years and the past 3 years alone of 10% annual growth, we're still at only 3% of the total domestic beer market. And so there's a huge room to grow. And I think craft brewers are going to continue to grow. You're not going to see quite as many open at the same pace that we had in the past, but you're going to see a lot of quality beer out there and a lot of quality beer making more beer for people.
Sounds great. Dan Gordon?
Yeah, I'm just going to try to do a little commercialized swaying movement here. It's cool to be green, but it's not cool to drink out of the green bottle. And by that I mean we are all producing local, high-quality beers, and there is no reason for anybody to ever buy an imported beer. Beer is something that's supposed to be enjoyed as fresh as possible, and it needs to be kept in pristine condition. So we are doing everything we can on our side of the table to re-educate the palate and to let you know what the good stuff tastes like. And all we want is for you to consider that every time you're going out to a restaurant or bar or buying a six-pack at a supermarket or a liquor store, to always be aware of, hey, the local stuff is going to be better. That was it.
Dave?
I think the best is definitely ahead of us. I think that the growth numbers that Nico pointed out, they feel extremely sustainable because they seem like You know, maybe compared to the mid-90s growth that was very trendy and hot, but didn't really ever take. In this case, you know, these numbers are supported by just the anecdotal evidence of the great local movement, the local everything. You know, the beer is now part of that local culture where you want to go to a new town, you go check out their farmer's market, you see what the local produce is, you go to the local brewery or pick up a six-pack of the local beer in their store. It now feels very connected to this very swelling, growing movement out there where people actually support artisanal products, and they celebrate the fact that, you know, it's different everywhere they go. There's a different, you know, there's a local brewery in that town, and you know, it becomes something that they want to try. It's it just feels like it's part of something much larger than just the craft beer industry these days, and I think that's where these growth numbers are coming from and why they're so sustainable.
Well, I think we've reached the close of our program. I wanted to thank everybody for coming out on Robert Burns Night. Robert Burns, the national poet of Scotland, was born on January 25th in the 18th century. And on Robert Burns Night around the world, people gather to commemorate the guy who wrote Auld Lang Syne and Raise a Cup of Kindness. And we're about to do just that, Raise Cups of Kindness, produced in San Francisco. Our thanks to our panelists, Justin Crossley of CBS Radio's The Brewcast and The Brewing Network. You can access that at thebrewingnetwork.com. John Foster, co-host of beerschool.com. Nico Fricha, the co-owner of 21st Amendment Restaurant and Brewery, accessed at 21st-amendment.com. Dan Gordon, the co-founder and director of brewing operations at Gordon Biersch. That's B-I-E-R-S-C-H. Dave McLean, owner and brewmaster at Magnolia Pub and Brewery, which is at magnoliapub.com. And all the San Francisco breweries are accessed at sfbrewersguild.org, where there are links to all of them, and anchorbrewing.com. We also would like to thank our audiences here, as well as our radio audience and program organizer, Suzanne Slider, Inforum, all the volunteers, members, and staff of the Commonwealth Club. I'm Bobby Coleman. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 103rd year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.